This is John Brotherhood, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee via Skype on the 15th, 16th and 17th of January 2013. John Brotherhood, Part 1.
My name is John Roland Brotherhood. I was born in Manby, Lincolnshire on the 5th of April 1940.
Would you say your father was an educated man?
Yes, he was indeed. He was a scholar to Monmouth School, and he was on the second intake at the Cranwell Royal Air Force College, and that would have been in the early 1930s.
What was it that made you have an interest in medicine?
Always had it. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think some of us that's just what we were going to do. I was always interested in biological things, and I don't think I ever had any sort of strong vocational, desire to go and heal people particularly. I just medicine was of interest to me.
What do you think was your first awareness that there might be a place on this planet called the Antarctic?
Good question. I think there are two things that got my interest in the Antarctic going. One was reading a book when I was probably about 10, I suspect, Arthur Ransome's book, I think it was called A Winter Journey.
Winter Holiday.
Winter Holiday.
I've just read it.
Oh, yes. Well, that really is, so that was very much, so I think that started, and then I was given a book Ponting's photographs. I think it was called With Scott to the Antarctic or something. It was a popular book in the sort of 50s. And I was given that book, and I think that probably sort of brought those two things together. And rather like medicine, I just felt I would always want to go to the Antarctic. And I was also interested, then I became interested, I think, in how people survived. I mean, how was it the humans survived in the Antarctic? So that became of interest to me.
So which came first, the desire to go to the Antarctic or the desire to do research which meant you had to go to the Antarctic?
Oh, I was going to the Antarctic. Having decided I would go to the Antarctic, what I wanted to know was how it was that humans survived or got on in the Antarctic, if you like, in the biological sense, physiological sense. Yes, in the physiological sense rather than the psychological sense, if you like. And then with regards to going on to doing the research, I then went and discussed these sort of interests with Otto Edholm, who was the head of the Medical Research Council at the time, and we came up with a research project. I applied to FIDS, I guess, as a medical officer, and then it was after that that the research project was determined.
What was your interview like? Can you remember much of it?
Well, with Bill Snowman?
Yeah.
Just a general chat. That's what Bill did. You had a chat, I suppose he's like the cut of your jib that you were in. And I guess it wasn't perhaps all that easy to get doctors. I don't remember it as being particularly frightening. I think Fox might have come in at some stage as well, but I'm not certain about that. I can't remember that. But anyway, it was just basically a chat with Bill Snowman. I don't remember it being particularly difficult to sell myself.
Were you sent for a medical?
Yeah, yes.
What do you recall of that?
Yeah. That I was told that I'd had pneumonia at some stage, which I wasn't aware of, but thinking back, I realised the occasion. Which, do you want a side story?
Yes, please, yes.
Yes, story. Yeah, when I was about, you see, now getting back to this whole business of why did I go to the Antarctic, when I was a boy in my sort of round about 10 to my very early teens, my father had lived in, or his home was in Tintern in the Wye Valley. And we used to go there for holidays. And across the road, there was another boy who was a little older than me, about, so I think he was a couple of years older than me. And we used to spend all our time in the woods and down by the river, and we made a map of the River Wye, and we knew all the fishing holes and that sort of thing. And so he was a very adventurous chap. And I think that's really what got me going on the Antarctic. What was the question again? I lost track.
I was asking you about
this side thing.
The pneumonia.
Oh, the pneumonia, that's right. Yes, that's right. And so we lost contact until I had actually graduated and was a doctor. And I was invited to their house for a New Year's Eve party. And I went to the house and I had a couple of beers and I began to feel extremely unwell. And I was very concerned that this chap's family would think I was just getting terribly drunk. But I went, I was basically unconscious for a day or two. Had a very high temperature, and I think that was probably a time when I'd had pneumonia, and we just thought it was the flu or something. Anyway, so
it sounds like the medical is quite thorough.
Yes, it was. Yes, we had chest X-rays and that sort of. Yes, I don't know, usual sort of urine test and that sort of thing. But we didn't have ECGs or it was just like the same sort of thing as an insurance medical.
Yeah. Did you have much time between being recruited and sailing south?
No, my recollection is that I would have applied at the beginning of 1965 when I was still doing a house job up in Chertsey. I was doing a casualty job in Chertsey, St. Peter's Chertsey, and I had finished that job, which I think finished in July. So in terms of preparing for my research, I had from really the end of July, I think, to November was when I sailed at Gister. So I had about 4 months to prepare my research. And in fact, I should have gone south on the Biscoe, which left, I think usually used to leave about October sometime. But because I was taking time to prepare my research, I actually went down on the Kista.
Did anybody from Bass vet your research program or check it over or advise you on it? Or did they just say, yeah, that's okay?
All the medical officers who decided to do medical research did it under the auspices of the Medical Research Council. And Professor Otto Edholm, who is head of the Medical Research Council at Holly Hill in Hampstead. So I think as far as Bass were concerned, if Otto agreed with the project, and in fact he very often, they had a whole series of projects they wanted doing in the Antarctic, then Bass were quite happy. I think they probably had an arrangement with the Medical Research Council that they would organise medical research.
How about gathering all the equipment you needed? Was that straightforward or was that complicated?
No, that was difficult, and the reason was that I wanted to measure energy expenditure, and measuring energy expenditure entails measuring oxygen consumption, which meant that I had to have a gadget that measured the volume of air that people breathed, but also took samples of their expired air, the air they breathed up, so I could analyze it for carbon dioxide and oxygen, and so I could... from that, I could measure the amount of oxygen that people consumed, during their daily activities. And I wanted to do this, of course, at very low temperatures. And there wasn't really any equipment at the time that did that satisfactorily. So I designed my own equipment and sort of built a prototype that would work at low temperatures. And in fact, Mike Bergin, who you've already interviewed, he was taken on as my assistant. He was very extremely good technically. And he actually built this equipment. He put the equipment together as far as we could. However, I needed a component that was the counter that counted the amount of air that was passing through the equipment. And that wasn't finally delivered. It was an absolutely critical piece of equipment, and it wasn't finally delivered until the day the ship sailed at Southampton. So that, you know, astonishing. You'd think, no wonder, you know, British industry was in a parlous state. You couldn't get anything. So that I mean, and if that piece of absolutely vital equipment hadn't arrived, my whole research project would have been pranged, because there was no way I could be got down to the Falkland Islands in time. So it couldn't be flown in those days. There wasn't flying in and out. So, yeah.
Were you having to chivvy them up, shall we say, to get it on time?
Yes, absolutely. The Medical Research Council, the man who was Stores manager, he was on their back all the time, and so eventually I was too. In fact, I seem to recall telephoning somebody on the Sunday before I went down to Southampton to get the boat.
Mike Bergin seems to suggest that some of the equipment was ex-Greenland to be used in the Arctic.
I used another piece of equipment which had been developed measuring energy expenditure in the British Army, developed by the Medical Research Council. Might have been used in Greenland before, and might have been used it would have been used also for research with the Army.
But he suggests that it was fairly cantankerous, this stuff, and he was having to take two or three pieces of equipment together to get one that would work, cannibalising the equipment.
Yes, I think that might have been the case too. Yes, because it was perhaps it hadn't been used for a few years, and we did what was called winterising it. So it was cleaned, all the grease was taken out, and it was actually lubricated with graphite. Which, of course, as you probably, I don't know if you know, that operates at very low temperatures and high temperatures. Any grease would have just got gummy.
Yeah. And was it bulky and difficult to manage?
Quite bulky. It was a knapsack. The portable integrating motor pneumatachograph, known as the PIMP, was a fairly heavy, rugged piece of equipment. That was what had been used for the Army, and it was worn in a knapsack, and you wore a mask on your face. Another reason for designing, and you had to wear a mask because the flow meter was actually on the mask. The other reason for my designing my own equipment was so that I could use it with a mouthpiece, because most Finns are a bit like you. They've got beards, and so face masks wouldn't have been any good because they would have leaked. So the piece of equipment that I designed was much lighter. It was fairly bulky. It had a volume of 9 litres, which was part of the design. But it was quite light. And it was quite ingenious, really, because we covered it in foam plastic, which insulated it. And because the expired air passed through the equipment, it actually kept it fairly warm. So freezing wasn't such a problem.
And what were you actually hoping to establish when you set off south? What was your grand plan? What were the results you were after?
I wanted to measure the energy cost of living in the Antarctic, which meant measuring the energy cost of all the outdoor activities, or as many of the outdoor activities as I could. And of course also indoor activities. The timed activity study. So I did daily diaries, which sometimes I did by direct observation. Other times I got the FIDs to actually keep a daily diary of all their activities. So every time they change an activity, they recorded the time. The other thing I did was to measure all their food intake with the ultimate goal of getting what we call an energy balance study. Prior to my going to the Antarctic, a number of people had measured food intake and found, perhaps not surprisingly, that people ate a lot more food. They ate a lot of energy. That suggested, of course, that the energy cost in the Antarctic was pretty high. Mm. But then, of course, the other question was, why was energy expenditure high in the Antarctic? And so that was another part of the research is to try to determine why energy expenditure is high in the Antarctic.
But was this pure research, or was there going to be an application afterwards?
I mean, that was pure research. That was just fundamental research. You know, what's the energy cost of the Antarctic, and what really is determining energy expenditure in the Antarctic?
Tell me about the journey south, John. What was it like?
Oh, that was terrific. I enjoyed that. The Kista, I can't remember how big the Kista was, but it wasn't very big. I had a 16 millimeter camera with me, and I took some film of a rather rough part of the voyage and sent it, and it went back to Kodak to be developed. And they said that once, when they looked at the film, they were all sick. But basically, we had a very pleasant voyage down through the down to the Atlantic. I might say that when we set out from Southampton, we went down. So we went west down the Solent, past the Needles, and it was fairly rough down in the Channel. It was fairly rough, so I thought I'd better be a good doctor and wandered around with a very large jar of seasick pills. But every now and then, I used to have to leave my patients rather rapidly and depart to the rail. But we all got over the seasickness. We got our sea legs after about 48 hours. We had a nice voyage. And there were wonderful things like flying fish, which I'd never seen before. We'd wake up in the morning and there'd be flying fish all over the deck. They rigged up a swimming pool, which you've heard about, no doubt. So we had a pool, which was rather fun. Phosphorescence, which I'd never seen before, and the bars, I mean, you know, the sea absolutely glowing, reflecting the stars, really. The one fascinating thing, really quite extraordinary, was round about, must have been the end of November, we'd had our evening meal, and it was still light. Dusk time, a bit before dusk. And I just went out on deck, and I happened to look up, and I saw two tiny little silver dots coming together. And you know, that was Gemini 6. Do you remember? You probably don't remember. Do you remember the early space program?
Oh, yes, I think around.
It was the first or second time that they'd actually docked the
aircraft were docking together.
The capsule, yeah. And I just happened to step out on deck at the time that was happening.
Was that with the naked eye, or were you using binoculars? Or
yeah, you could see it. You know, you've probably seen satellites. Mm. And it was just the right time of the day. The sun was just setting, and so there were these two little silver dots.
Were you actually looking for it? Were you stepping on deck?
No. Just happened to look up, and there they were. Extraordinary. Quite extraordinary. Rest of the voyage,
Carry on.
We had the usual crossing the line ceremony, which wasn't too brutal, if I recall. I can't remember who was Neptune and who was his queen. Pretty ugly, both of them. Then the next thing, of course, was going into Stanley. We went into Stanley in the evening. It was just so atmospheric, you wouldn't believe it. It was absolutely still. And as you go in through the heads at Stanley, to the north, there's a place called Sparrow Cove, where the Great Britain was in those days. And you could see her there. And I think there was another hulk there as well. And as we went in, there was just not so much an inversion, but the smoke was sort of from the fires was just parallel, and there was this wonderful smell of peat smoke. Very evocative, very, very atmospheric. And anyway, so we docked there, and then, as you know, we went to the Falkland Islands store and bought goodies, cameras and so on, which were all very cheap. I bought an Nikon for £5, I think. and we got kitted out at the Bass store. But that that entry into full, into the Falkland Islands, I then went on and did, when I came back from the Antarctic, I did a locum job in the Falkland Islands later on.
What are your memories of the hospital there? Did you go in, did you visit the hospital?
No, I didn't. I visited the doctor, Slessor, a courtesy visit, but I didn't go, don't recall going to the hospital.
Yeah. And then south, was that on the same ship or was that, did he transfer?
No, I went on the Kister, and the Kister went into Sydney and unloaded me and a lot of equipment. I suppose Mike Bergen was with me as well. I forget whether he was on the Kister or not. Anyway, so the Kister went into Sydney, as I say, some stores were unloaded. My stores, I think my medical stores, in fact, were unloaded. They hadn't had a doctor on Sydney before, so they had a fairly basic medical kit. On basis where there were medical officers, there was a sort of a medical officer's kit as well, and so that went ashore.
What were your first impressions, having wanted to go to the Antarctic all your life? What, did it match up to your expectations?
It was all a bit, you know, I mean, you can imagine there was a certain amount of trepidation. I mean, you know, we're going to be away. But basically, I mean, I seem to remember thinking it was pretty good. As much as anything, I'm, you know, meeting a lot of new people who I was going to live with for a time. I mean, that's always a bit sort of, and I was going to be base commander as well as, or base leader, I think they were called in those days, as well as doctor. So it was a little bit, you know, that sort of aspect of things was a bit...
Responsible?
Not so much. Sorry?
You felt what responsibility. Was the word you? Responsibility.
Yes, I suppose so, yeah. But more, you know, how were we going to get on, I suppose.
How come you were appointed base leader in your first season?
I don't know. They just asked me if I'd do it. I suppose they felt there wasn't any... Well, I suppose I was best of a bad lot, perhaps.
How was it? Because you were arriving at a base where half the people had been there for a year already and assuming command. So how was that?
Well, the base leader I was taking over, a chap called Mike Northover, who I think has actually died... He was pretty good. We had long discussions, and I seem to remember sort of walking around the base a little bit and walking around the island, just having discussions about just running the base. There was, I didn't particularly mind sort of taking... The other thing, of course, there were what we used to call summer charlies. So there were people there who were just there for summer work. And there were one or two people who had already spent a year there. Not very many of them. And most of us were first-year people, I think, if I recall. I think Inigo Everson had done his first... Had done a year there. Nigel Bacon, the cook, I think... I think they were about the only, most of us were new, actually. Just trying to think of the other people. There were others who had already wintered there, but they were going to go out. They were going back north.
Did they brief you about, apart from talking to the existing base commander, did Bass give you any particular training or briefing about how to run a base? Before you left?
No, not that I recall. No, you know, it was quite interesting. In many ways, we were just chucked in the deep end. I mean, they must have had the most, very interesting. There was a manual, which I seem to remember said, amongst other things, that conversations involving women, politics, and religion should be avoided.
That was written down, you know, somewhere.
I think it was in the. Yeah. But that must have been just taken straight out of an officer's mess, sir. You know, stuff. It was just sort of, you know.
Did you mindfully adopt a certain approach? Like, for example, at one extreme, you might have been very much a committee man or a cabinet man, or you could have been a dictatorial type of leader. Did you choose a particular style?
I don't think I particularly chose any style. I don't remember sort of being, certainly don't remember particularly being a commander. I mean, there were things like, you know, there were things that had to be done to run the base. And I sort of organized, it was as a matter of, you know, organized rosters like the GASH and that sort of thing. I suppose my main concerns were safety. That was more difficult because we were quite a small base. They were all biologists who needed to go out. You know, they had to work in the field. It wasn't as though they were sitting operating instruments. So there were times when that got a bit tricky. Just making sure one had enough people around to, you know, if there was an accident or something, we had enough people around to deal with it.
I guess the problem was balancing health and safety against people's needs and desires to get on with the job.
That's right. And also people's needs to get on with the job, but also people's the non-scientists also needed to have recreational. They needed to be able to get out as well. And there were times when I think they were a little frustrated because maybe I had all the biologists out in the field and I said, no, you know, we've got to have two or three of us here in case there's a problem. Mm. And that used to cause a bit of friction. But as far as possible, if a biologist was going out, you know, I'd try and send one of the other guys with them.
Do you remember a particularly difficult decision or a particularly difficult day when you were challenged in your...
Yeah, there was one day in the spring when nearly all the biologists were out, and one chap particularly wanted to go and look for plankton in the pack ice, which meant taking a boat out. That was a day when I felt that things were a little bit stretched, and I had to be pretty firm that that three or four of us had to be back on base, and be prepared to get people out.
Who were the characters in that year at Cygni? Who do you recall particularly?
They were all characters, really. As I suppose Inigo Everson, who you probably met, he was first class. He was an excellent chap. He was a marine biologist, but very good man, very good. Likely to be a joker, but absolutely first class when it came to doing stuff that needed to be done. Nigel Bacon was our cook. I think he was doing his second year. I think he was 19 when he went down. Remarkably responsible job being cook, because he looked after the stores and that sort of thing. And he was absolutely first class. Looked after the catering absolutely perfectly. There were never any problems with stores. He was a very good cook, imaginative cook. And what's more, he took on the seal tagging program in the spring, his last spring. He'd assisted the previous year, and he took on the seal tagging and did it extremely well. It was a routine job, but it had to be done methodically, and he did that very well.
No, you carry on, John. You carry on.
Like I say, our radio operator, Sean, Steve O'Shaughn, who was, I guess, an Irish cockney, he was a bundle of fun. He was really, again, very young fella, 19, done, I think, a marine wireless ops course somewhere in, tech college, I think. But again, first-class man. Yeah, they were all good, but those were the three sort of, I think, people I really remember. But they were all first class in their different ways.
Did you find yourself becoming involved in the biological animal biology yes. that was going on?
Yes, probably too much. Well, I was fascinated. I mean, I'm sure you understand, medicine gives you a very broad education in biological techniques. So I was actually familiar with pretty well everything that was going on, you know, the microbiology, cutting sections of for microscopy. I'd done all this. So I was really very interested in what was going on. And from time to time, I used to go into the labs, and partly just to see that people were, you know, able to get on with their work and they were sort of happy in their work and weren't getting any problems, but also interesting. I think sometimes people thought I was snooping too much. I wasn't really snooping. I was just really very interested in what they were doing. And, of course, would it get involved in discussion?
Discussions about what?
Well, what they were doing. I don't think, why are you doing it that way? Or, you know, really for my own information rather than actually checking that they were doing it right. But I sometimes thought that I was being misunderstood.
Did you do any diving?
No, I didn't do any diving myself. But Inigo Everson and Martin White, who was one of the two marine biologists, they dived under the ice. And it was the first time that that Bass had done any diving. So again, there we were, you know, doing this pioneering work with absolutely nothing in the way of follow-up in those days. I mean, you know, just do it.
Did you?
Oh, I mean, obviously, it was done with caution and care and so on. But that was quite an adventurous thing to do.
Yeah. Did you ever do any doctoring? Were your doctor skills called upon?
Yes. Yes.
What can you tell me?
Well, you were asked me what it was like when I went ashore, first time went ashore. Well, I'd only been ashore, I think I just had some lunch. And Ron Lloyd, who was on the Kister going down to Halley Bay, came ashore and said, oh, one of the stewards has got appendicitis. I think we should do an appendicectomy. So, hello. This is not something, to be taken too lightly. So I went onto the ship and rather agreed that, it seemed likely that this chap had got appendicitis, and then what were we to do? The captain wasn't very keen that he should be on the ship, because if it blew up, that was going to be difficult for them. Likewise, I wasn't too happy. So he could stay with me and be treated conservatively. But if that didn't work, I was going to be on my own. But since we had two doctors, we thought, if you've got appendicitis, the best thing to do is, or the definitive treatment is to get the thing out. So we did this. That was done in the main biology lab. The whole place was stripped out and scrubbed and cleaned, and we did this surgery. Ron Lloyd, who had actually, I think he'd been a junior registrar, he'd done quite a lot of surgery. He did the operation, and I administered the anaesthetic, which was quite interesting. I used ether on what was called a Himmelbusch mask, which was basically a metal mask, like a clip, like two pieces of coconut, if you like, and you just put gauze between the, you know, in this sort of wire mask thing, and dropped ether on it. And I'd done anaesthetics. One does a short amount of anaesthetics as a student, but of course with conventional anaesthetic equipment. So this was rather new. We barely had enough equipment. I think we only had one pair of surgical gloves. And John Baker, who done some medical worked as a medical technician as a student in as a vac job, he assisted in the surgery. And he had these amazing leather gloves that were used, I think, for probably cleaning seals or something, big, long leather gloves, like gardening gloves. Yes, so that went ahead, you know, fortunately without a hitch. I found that giving the anesthetic was very interesting. You could get extraordinary control from time to time. Ron would say, "Oh, he's a bit tight," which meant the muscles of his abdomen were a bit tight, and he was having difficulty getting access to the appendix and so on. So I'd put a little bit more ether on, and immediately the muscles would relax. So that was what you call a steep learning curve. Interesting hindsight. And the chap recovered. He stayed on Cygni and recovered, and he was picked up by a ship later.
Have you ever done an appendix operation since?
Sorry, say that again?
Have you ever done an appendix operation since?
No, well, I stopped clinical medicine not long after leaving the Antarctic. But as you probably know, Ron Lloyd we did another appendicectomy in Halley Bay the following year. Ron Lloyd. But there were three of us on that occasion. There was a doctor who had actually worked as an anaesthetist. There's Ron Lloyd, who had been a surgeon, and there was me. And so together we had a first-class medical team. That was at Halley Bay.
What was it like living at Cygni? What sort of facilities did he have? There was a plastic palace, wasn't there?
Yes, fiberglass. It was extremely comfortable. Really, really very nice indeed. We had the bunk rooms were shared. There were two, actually, I think there might have been four bunks, but for our wintering party, I think basically there were one or two people in each bunk room. As base leader, I had my own room, which was also my office. But very, very comfortable bunk rooms. It was reasonably warm. I don't remember being cold indoors at any time. Plenty of electricity. I was very comfortable. Very good cook. Excellent laboratory facilities. We had very good labs, three good laboratories and a marine, and what was called a wet lab where the fish and the marine stuff was done. Very good. With regarding that the two things, two sort of rather fundamental things. One was water, and the other was the bog. But we'll talk about the water first, if it's of interest to you. That in the autumn, there was a time when everything froze. Starting with water in the summer, we got our water from meltwater that ran down the back slope into a big water tank. So we had running water. But then in the autumn, the running water would freeze before it snowed, and so we had no snow to cut for ice blocks, which were then melted. So we had this period of about a week or 10 days when we actually had no water available on base. So luckily, there was some ice around, pack ice around on the sea, and we were able to find little bits of glacier ice, which we chopped up and used for water. But for a time there, it was quite an interesting period of time. Getting to the other end of proceedings, the bog was an outside latrine, just a wooden hut, you know, one hola, which from time to time would get drifted up, so you couldn't get in. And I remember on one occasion watching a chap going to the window and looking out of the window at sort of regular intervals, and wondering what it was he was looking at. And later on, I realized what, in fact, he was waiting. He was waiting for somebody to dig the bog up so that he could go. Anyway.
Well, wasn't that...
So,
was the person who dug the bog out normally the base commander, in fact?
Not at all, no. It was the chap whose deed was the greatest.
One of my spies tells me that you often were out there first thing in the morning digging the toilet out.
I don't recall that.
You don't recall that?
No, that was either somebody pulling my leg or being very kind. No, don't recall that.
You don't remember an occasion where you dug the toilet out and before you could nip in yourself, Everson got there before you?
Oh, that would be right. Well, that's Inigo. Yes, that certainly could be right.
Okay.
But I don't remember the occasion.
It was quite a noisy building, the Plastic Palace, wasn't it? You had to be careful with doors. The Plastic Palace is quite a noisy building. You had to be careful with your footsteps and with doors.
I don't remember that being particularly a problem. Can't remember.
You never kept awake with slamming doors?
No. Don't remember that.
Okay. I forgot to ask you about dentistry. I think you were involved in or the recipient of some dentistry at Signy.
Yeah, I think the only dentistry, if I recall it, Signy was on myself.
Yeah.
Actually, Chris, this brings us to three things regard the last ship, the departure of the last ship, which might be of interest to you.
Please, yeah.
Get my notes. Yeah, on the last ship, which was the John Biscoe, which left at the end of March, if I recall, there was a dentist, and I'd had trouble with a tooth. And I'd had it looked at in London, and they'd sort of said, oh, they couldn't see anything. That might have been before dental x-rays. Anyway, I'd had this sort of slight sort of nagging tooth, and it had sort of continued. And I asked the dentist on the Biscoe to have a look at it, and he had a pretty good look, and he said he couldn't detect anything. He did various tests and seemed to think it was all okay. Anyway, and so the last, the last ship sailed off. And, I don't know how long, but a couple of weeks later, maybe a month later, this tooth really blew up. And I got, I got quite severe toothache. Mm. And it was not really going away. And I can't remember whether I'd taken some, I think I probably took some antibiotics, but I can't remember that particular detail. But anyway, I just came to the conclusion that it really wasn't going to recover. So I can't remember how John Baker came up, but anyway, I must have asked for volunteers to extract this, or maybe I felt that John was a competent sort of chap. And so I asked him to take this tooth out, which he duly did. I can't remember what I used. I think I probably took a lot of codeine.
Scotch.
Which is an analgesic. Yeah, I can't remember that. Maybe that too. But, okay, it wasn't all that bad. And I recovered and, obviously recovered. But having got the tooth out, it was quite clear that it wasn't a good tooth at all. The bottom of it was absolutely rotten.
Yeah.
So, now, the next story about the last ship was we had two old ex-army in the radio check transmitters, and there was a spare transmitter. And Steve, a Sean radio operator, had determined that the standby or the spare transmitter wasn't working properly, which was a bit of a worry. In fact, it had an intermittent fault. It would operate, it would go, and then it would just cut out. And so he got the radio operator from the John Biscoe to come and have a look, and they had a look at it. he couldn't work out what was wrong with it at all. It was a typical intermittent fog. Anyway, to cut a long story short, after the ship had gone, Steve was, I was in the shack just discussing these things with him, and he said, "Oh, you know, this bloody thing doesn't work properly," or something, and he gave it a kick. And there was this little tinkling sound. And we opened the cabinet, and at the bottom there was an 8BA nut. And this nut had just got caught somewhere, and after that it worked perfectly. Yeah. Yeah, well, then finally you asked me what I thought about being at Signy. And my birthday was April the 5th. And so that was about 10 days after the last ship had gone. And I remember just walking up to a place called the Bluff and looking out over these on my birthday, just on my own, and going up and looking out and seeing that the pack ice was coming in and that we were really actually going to be surrounded and this was going to be the winter. The last ship had gone and that was it. And I remember thinking, well, that's it. We've started, and just hoping that things would be okay.
When did you, and how did you broach to the other guys the subject of being your guinea pigs?
If I recall, I would have had a sort of a general chat to them, you know, probably after a meal one evening or something like that, and told them about my project and what I was trying to do. And asking, you know, telling them obviously it was very important that they be subjects and so on. And by and large, people were pretty cooperative. But some people, you know, didn't particularly like wearing the apparatus. I suppose they felt that it interfered with them, which it might have done a little bit, but not really particularly. One or two people really objected to it. One chap I remember really objecting because he thought it was work, and I wanted to measure him when he was skiing, and he said, "No, this is recreation, and that's work. I'm not going to be involved in that." So it wasn't actually always easy.
Let's pick up. We were talking about Signy, and you had one or two more thoughts since we last spoke on the Skype.
Just going back to the various aspects of various things that happened within a few days of the last ship leaving us. The other thing that I'd forgotten to mention was one of the boys developed renal colic. This is extremely uncomfortable pain down the side when stones pass from the kidney down the ureters into the bladder. And it's very uncomfortable and unusual in a young man. And normally one would have to investigate that in a hospital. Not so much as a matter of urgency, but one certainly would want to know why a young man was getting that sort of pain. Anyway, clearly there wasn't very much I could do about that except treat the discomfort, because the ship had gone. So that was potentially a bit of a worry, but I was able to examine his urine, and he had what I thought were probably uric acid crystals in his urine. And I think the reason for that was that when the ships came in, we got fresh meat in the shape of usually a sheep's carcass from the Falkland Islands. But of course, at Signy, we couldn't preserve those because we didn't have cold conditions and we didn't have very big fridge space. So we had to more or less eat these beasts, as quick as we could. And I think this particular individual had really enjoyed a lot of mutton. And maybe that was why he had this rather sort of concentrated urine. Anyway, fortunately, he had no further symptoms. But interestingly, sometime after he returned to the United Kingdom, he had a repeat, and he did in fact have an abnormal kidney.
Were you taking urine samples on a regular basis from all the men?
No, I wasn't. But since you asked the question about urine, my successor, Richard Hillier, who was another doctor who came on to Signy after me, and I think he was also a base leader. His research project was looking into what we call cold diuresis. You're probably aware of the phenomenon that when we go out in the cold, very often we find we want to pee more frequently. So the question for Richard was whether there were any evidence of adaptation, whether for a standard cold stress people peed less after living for a year in the Antarctic. Anyway, as I'd said previously, my research project involved the collection of expired air, and sometimes I used large plastic bags to collect this expired air. And Richard, of course, was collecting urine. And not long after I left Sydney, I had a telegram from Steve O'Shaughn, who was our radio operator, saying, "You doctors are nothing but a load of wind and piss." So that was fairly typical of the sort of humour that went on.
Well, one or two of your colleagues accused you of taking the piss. I presume they were talking metaphorically, were they?
Oh, yes, I think so, probably, yes.
Was there a good sense of humour on base at Sydney?
Yes, there was. Excellent, yes. Yes, yes, by and large, I mean, we... I think Inigo is a sort of a natural comedian, really. Oh, and the even more natural comedian was Steve O'Shaughn, who, as I say, was an Irish Cockney, and he was full of sort of amusing sort of anecdotes and things, you know. And if anybody had the slightest disagreement with you, he'd say, "You won't bother," and so on. So yeah, there was quite a lot of reasonable humour, I think.
How was punctuality on base, John?
That's a loaded question, isn't it?
It is.
Yes, well, by and large, pretty good. I'm not the best, never have been very good at getting up in the morning, but I, you know, wasn't too bad. Most guys got up pretty early in the morning. Punctuality generally, there was one chappy who really got up at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, if I recall, and he was a total night bird. And he went to bed, you know, when we got up.
So let's go back now to these tests that you were conducting on your colleagues. And
yes,
they tell me you made them do step tests outdoors whilst this was going on.
One of the questions, of course, was what might increase energy expenditure in the Antarctic. So the idea was to do a standard test of standard exercise, which is stepping on and off a box, and to do that outside and to do that inside in the warm and see if there were any differences between doing this standard exercise and outside in the cold and doing it inside in the warm. That proved actually to be more difficult than I'd expected because the big plastic bags I used for collecting air became very brittle in the cold and they broke. So sometimes I'd have a nice full bag of air and then I picked it up and the thing would just split open. So I abandoned doing it outside in the cold, but I continued doing these tests in the warm because the test can also be used for measuring physical fitness. And so it was. I was interested to see whether physical fitness changed during the year. And there was some evidence of that people were a little less fit at the end of the winter, but got fitter again as the days got longer and people spent longer outside.
Did it also vary depending upon the kind of job they were doing? So was the cook less fit than the GAs?
Yes, there was some evidence of that. In fact, the person whose fitness changed the most, who increased the most, was actually Ron Smith, because he did a lot of cross-country skiing as part of his work. And so when he got back to work, sampling mosses, I think, his fitness improved considerably, by about 15%, if I recall, which is quite a big increase. The others were sort of smaller changes. I wasn't able to measure everybody, partly, I think, because, you know, it didn't sort of fit in with their other duties, and also perhaps because they didn't want to be involved. Just to get back to your question, was there a difference between the GAs and the more sedentary people? I don't know the answer to that.
You were doing all this on one of the longest and coldest winters on record at Cygni. Does that add to the problem?
No, I don't think so. No, I hadn't realised that. I mean, I guess at that stage we just accepted the winter as it is. I mean, if it turns out that it was a long, cold winter, well, I mean, I don't think we were particularly aware of that at the time. I certainly don't remember that as being an important factor.
Let's move on to other matters. You were trialling Skidoos in 1966.
Yes.
How was all that?
Yes, indeed. Well, that was that's right. Skidoos or motorised toboggans, and I suppose the Skidoo was the best available at the time, hadn't been used by Bass at all. They were sent to Cygni. We had two. And Mike Bergin, he undertook the sort of maintenance of these machines, and as far as I recall, kept very careful notes and was able to make a pretty good report, I think, on these Skidoos at the end of the winter or at the end of the year. We actually used them a lot. We used them for recreational purposes, of course, but also the biologists used them a lot for travelling in the winter across the sea ice and around the island. And they were pretty good. They were reasonably reliable. They could be difficult to start, a bit like outboard motors were in those days. But once they were going, they were pretty good.
How did you take to them personally?
Fine. I mean, you know, I can't remember whether I drove them very much. I'm not sure that I did, actually. I probably didn't have any particular need to, but they were quite easy to drive, and they were fine.
Did you have feast days on base when there was a public holiday? Did you mark the occasion?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, public holidays. My recollection is Cygni had an average of 13 hours of sunshine a month. So it was really overcast pretty well all the time. And so whenever we had a cloudless, bright, sunny day, that was always declared a national holiday. And that would basically that involved sort of recreational activities. We would play soccer on the ice, or a couple of occasions we went across to Coronation Island and climbed about on the Coronation. So they were, you know, so sunny days were always celebrated. There was a good meal every Saturday night. We didn't have any other formal entertainment for Saturdays, unlike Halle Bay, which had films on Saturday night. We more or less entertained ourselves. Birthdays, of course, are always celebrations there. So I think that, and usually that involved, of course, a good meal and a birthday cake cooked by Nigel Bacon.
There are rumours of barbecues on sunny days.
Yes, indeed, barbecues. Yes, thank you for reminding about that. And at midwinter we had barbecues. We built barbecues on the ice. And also we have rather interesting firework displays. These were basically oil drums, which had a certain amount of waste oil in them. Ernie Thornley, our diesel mech, solder the tops on or screw the tops on. And then these were heated up on fires, and they exploded with great satisfaction. But on one occasion, we heard a lid going not very far above our heads, like a flying saucer. So potential danger there, I suppose, but quite good fun.
So all in all, your first year as base commander at Cygni, how would you summarise it? How looking back on it now, how did it go?
Oh, I think pretty satisfactorily. I can remember occasionally during the winter, I'm not so much getting depressed, but sort of rather wondering if I would, you know, how I would cope with another winter. So that's personally. I think with regards to the base, I mean, morale was generally, I think, excellent. There were one or two hiccups with morale, which was much to do with things like unexpected duties. The scientists were asked to undertake some of the meteorological program. And we hadn't had much training for that, and that, I think, upset one or two people. But apart from that, I think it all went extremely well. We got on very well. I mean, whether people disliked each other or not, I don't know. It certainly didn't come to the fore at all. So I think, by and large, it was a happy year.
Did you have any techniques for countering the blue days, for coping with sadness or depression?
Not really. I don't. Well, there was one man who was, I think, clearly depressed, and I used to talk to him from time to time. But otherwise, I think probably people were. They didn't come to me with problems like that, which, I mean, that might have been one of the problems, of course, being a base leader and a medical officer. Probably not a good combination, in fact.
Why do you say that? Confidentiality?
Well, I think... Sorry?
Confidentiality.
Well, but partly confidentiality and partly because, I mean, you know, the base leader is there to be the base leader and so on, and the medical officer there is, you know, is really the person for whom people should feel comfortable in going to confide in. And they might, I don't know whether people felt this, but they might have felt that, you know, that the base leader wasn't necessarily the person to go and talk to if they were, you know, troubled in any way. Certainly if people had anything physically wrong with them, they came and spoke to me as the doctor. But I don't know about sort of psychological things, whether there was any sort of inhibition there because there might have been some perception of sort of ambiguity in the two roles. Mm.
Can you think of an example of that when you were concerned about that without necessarily naming a name?
No. Well, as I say, there was one particular individual who didn't actually consult me, but I was aware of the fact that he was not very happy and spoke to him from time to time or made it clear that I was very happy to, you know, to talk to him, but he didn't really, I think we discussed some of the things that were making him unhappy, that's right, I recall that, and in fact, part of that was because he had a dual role which he wasn't very happy with, and I tried to deal with that.
Okay. You signed up for two winters, hadn't you, at the very beginning of all this?
Yes.
Did you know where your second winter was going to be?
No, I didn't. And I didn't know where my first winter was. Now, it was, you know, it was fairly unusual, if you like, for a doctor to sign on for 2 years. The reason I did that was because of my research project, I thought, well, you know, it would take me a year to really learn about living in the Antarctic. Then in my second year, I could, you know, apply the knowledge gained in the previous year to sort of focusing the research and also perhaps having refined my techniques and so on. So that's why I signed on for 2 years. I'd rather hope to go down the peninsula so that I could get some sledging, because that was obviously a very important part of British Antarctic activities in those days. When I was posted to Halley Bay and then told that we were going to build Halley Bay and that there would be very limited opportunities for sledging, that was quite a considerable disappointment to me.
So when did you hear that you were going to be posted to Halley Bay for the second season?
I can't remember that, but it would have been towards the end of that year in Sydney. I can't remember exactly when it was.
Were you pleased with the news or were you disappointed?
Well, I didn't mind going to Halley Bay particularly because, I mean, I knew that there was a sledging program there. I'm not sure if I knew at that stage that there was going to be this big building program. And furthermore, because we had a lot of people on base at Halley Bay at that time, in 1967 or wherever it was, Ricky Chin very properly didn't want me to be far from base at any time. So I really, my sort of field activities were greatly reduced at Halley Bay. So that was a disappointment.
So you did no sledging at all?
No, I did. I did 10 days sledging with Alan Johnson, who was a surveyor, and Ken Halliday, who was one of our radio operators. And basically, that trip was a trip for a recreational trip for Ken and myself. But also, I used that for doing some physiology as well.
Halley would have been much more of a building site than Cygni, wouldn't it? A very different atmosphere.
Oh, yes. I mean, that was, yes. At that time, we built the Halley Bay 3. I think, what were the nine new huts, big huts. That was a very big, busy building program throughout the year. I mean, we got all the huts built before the winter set in, but then, of course, we spent the winter, or at least the building team certainly spent the winter fitting out the huts. During that time, some of us, before the accommodation was built at Halley Bay, at Grillage Village, the new place, a number of us lived down in the old base for, probably almost until midwinter, certainly 3 or 4 months before the accommodation in the new base was available for us.
What kind of condition was the old base in?
Oh, that was interesting and absolutely appalling. There were two bases there. There was the original IGY hut, which was 30 feet below the surface at that stage, and was slowly being, the heat had been turned off from that hut and it was slowly being crushed. But the second base, which I think was built around about 1962 or something like that, I forget exactly, some vital components, I think bolts or something, had been left out of the building equipment. And so it was basically falling apart. For example, when I first started sleeping there in the summer, I slept in a bunk room where the ceiling of the bunk room was, which was basically the roof as well, was beginning to cave in. And I slept on the top bunk. After a few weeks, I had to move out of the top bunk because the roof had just come right down. And I couldn't get into that bunk anymore, so I slept in the bottom bunk for a bit. But the temperature in there was always below freezing. I mean, I think the warmest conditions were probably about -5, -10. And for those guys, for the static program guys, the meteorologists and the physicists who were living down there, they lived on base the whole winter because that's where their equipment was. And those guys, they slept in temperatures every night that were about -20 centigrade. I mean, really, really cold and miserable.
Was it worrying to be in a hut that was creaking and groaning and changing its shape?
No, the main problem was that, first of all, the old hut, the old IGY hut, as I say, that was being slowly crushed. See, it's not like a mine. The ice just slowly encroaches and crushes things. And I had a temporary lab in the old hut. And every now and then there used to be, there was the most enormous crack. The roof beams and the roof trusses would split just like a matchstick splitting. But there'd be no movement at all. I mean, there was no risk of anything sort of falling in or caving in. By contrast, the newer base, where we were actually living, the temperature, as I say, was a lot warmer than that. And the main problem was that it leaked water. So that not only was it pretty cold and chilly, but it was often very wet. And so we had sort of sheets of plastic all over the place to try and, try and keep some of the place dry. So it wasn't much fun at all.
What were your duties then as doctor? Were you helping to build these new huts or were you fully occupied medically?
But in the summer, everybody was all hands on deck to build. So we were all involved, and I was completely involved in building or erecting the new huts, constructing the new huts. And I spent a certain amount of time helping with the fitting out. Then I think the fitting out became a little bit more expert, if you like, and the building team were more or less concerned with that. And I sort of then started to do my research program. But also Big Al Smith built the surgery there and fitted out the surgery. When he'd done that, I sort of painted out the surgery and moved all the sort of medical equipment into the surgery and so on. And that was the time, by that time, I suppose it was getting on for a little after midwinter. I had to start planning the medical equipment for the field teams, putting that together. And that was when I started to write Curafid.
Well, tell me about the genesis of Curafid. Was it simply because there was nothing else to refer to?
The sledging satchels had this factory first aid for a manual, and I think also Merchant Marine ship's sort of first aid manual. Whilst these were quite useful, I was aware of the fact that they really were just first aid things and very much for sort of lay people. And so in that regard, were limited. So I decided that, I mean, for example, there was no real proper instruction on how to suture a wound or how to manage a longer-term fracture of a limb, that sort of thing. Or indeed, if somebody had the bellyache. So those sort of general sort of medical questions. So I wrote Curafid to try and fill those gaps. And then, of course, it developed. When I got back to the UK, it was developed further.
So it was all hammered out on a typewriter in your surgery, was it, originally?
Yeah, absolutely, with two fingers. I'm not a typist, even today.
And it's just been republished.
Oh, yes, I think it's a very different beast to what it was. But nonetheless, I mean, it kicked it off. And I understand it's actually used internationally now. I think a lot of other organisations, apart from FIDS, use it. And I think it might even be used for non-polar regions as well.
Did you have many medical problems? Because there are obviously in a building site, there's more scope for accident.
No, we were extremely lucky. A couple of guys complained of piles, and I told them not to sit on coal steel girders. Medical problems. We had no injuries or medical problems associated, serious medical problems associated with the building. We were extremely lucky. I mean, there was the odd chippy got splinters and so on, but I can't remember. No, I don't think there were any serious problems associated with the building.
Carry on.
As you know, there was another appendicectomy, again at the time of the changeover. One of the gash hands who had been working as a general assistant climbing on South Georgia had developed appendicitis. In fact, it was clear that he'd had a grumbling appendix for some time, even when he was in South Georgia.
Was this wee Georgie McLeod?
Yes, indeed. In fact, we were working shifts, 24 hours on doing this building, and I was going from the ship where I was sleeping at the time to the building site, and I passed George McLeod. It just so happened that a caravan, which was a little caboose, which was like a sort of a safety station between the ship and the new base, and he hailed me and said, "Oh, I don't feel too good, Doc." So I sort of asked him a few questions and said, "Oh, well, maybe you've eaten something that didn't agree with you." And he went off back to base. And the next thing I knew was he'd gone one step further, and Ron Lloyd had seen him, and again, appendicitis was diagnosed. And there was an Australian doctor there called Dick, who was obviously, his name was Dick Doc, who in fact had done, a registrar's job as an anaesthetist. And we had sophisticated anaesthetic equipment at Halley Bay. So surgery was carried out in the old surgery on the old base at Halley Bay, and George recovered.
What's all this about the midwinter pantomime that you took part in, which brought the subject of contraception into the lives of the Halley men?
That was a lot of fun. What was going to be the science block had not been fitted up by midwinter, and so we had this empty hut. And a group of us sort of erected a stage, and I think we even had a curtain and so on, and we put on a little pantomime. Which was basically about the experience, I think, of a character called Fid, who is obviously, this is a sort of a just an account, a pantomime based on Fid's experience. Fanny Hill, Dave Hill was Fid, I think. Peter Noble wrote a lot of rather good songs and played good songs, and Old Sir Vivian Had a Bass was one of them. And a chap called Nick Mathis, who was a Gash hand, told me about some joke about contraception. And that, of course, sowed seeds. And once you start thinking about contraception, it didn't take long to find any sort of hollow, tubular, rubber good that was around the base, upon which one could build quite an amusing skit, which is what I did. And I think I had this little suitcase, and we had things like, gloves, which were for people who enjoyed multiple partners, and finger stools, which are very small rubber things, and I think they were for midgets, and balloons with drawings on them, which were funny fuckers, and I think inner tube tires from sledge wheels, which I forget what the punchline for that was. And the final line, and I forget the punchline, was, I dragged a rubber Met balloon out of the suitcase, and had to walk twice around the stage, I think, to get the whole thing out, by which time I think there were serious cases of collapse in the audience.